Imagine a time when humanity genuinely believed they could mathematically calculate and just steer the entire future. Like it was some giant geopolitical game of SimCity.
Right, yeah. Like you could just plug society into a dashboard and turn a steering wheel.
Exactly. I mean, in the late 1960s, the West German government actually handed 2 million marks to a former NASA aerospace engineer to see if he could replace their political bureaucracy with a cybernetic computer simulation.
Which is just wild to think about now.
It is. They genuinely believed they could take a government made of lawyers and politicians and turn it into a mathematically optimized machine. And spoiler alert, the politicians absolutely hated it, and the entire project went down in flames in a very spectacular way.
Oh yeah, it's arguably one of the most spectacular culture clashes in modern political history. And it, you know, it perfectly encapsulates this very specific moment in time when we really thought we could program human society just like you would a rocket ship.
Welcome to Futures Research Unpacked. In today's deep dive, we are looking at a really fascinating historical review paper by Elk Seafried. It's called Steering the Future.
Yeah, and to give you, the listener, a clear overview of what we're dealing with right off the bat, this paper is fundamentally a massive historical synthesis. It's a review paper.
Right, so we're looking at a broad overview of an entire era.
Exactly. The scope of Seafried's review covers how futures research, or futurology as they called it, evolved right after World War II. She traces how it moved from these very niche transatlantic think tanks all the way up into the highest levels of government planning, specifically in the US and West Germany.
And what I love about how she organizes this paper is that it's not just a dry timeline. She takes this really chaotic history and brilliantly organizes it by identifying three distinct approaches that emerge.
Right, she breaks them down into the data-driven positivists, the philosophical normatives, and then the activist-driven critical approach.
Which is super helpful for understanding who is fighting over the steering wheel, basically.
Exactly. And by organizing it that way, she really highlights the main trend of the 1960s, which she calls this massive euphoria of steering.
Euphoria of steering. That's such a great phrase.
It really is. It was fueled by the post-war economic boom and the arrival of the very first large-scale computers. Politicians across the entire political spectrum were just gripped by this intense can-do mindset. They honestly believed science could finally cure the unpredictability of human society.
But of course, the paper also reveals this massive blind spot of the era. I mean, the absolute failure of these futurists to understand the messy, totally non-quantifiable nature of, well, human bureaucracy and political survival.
Which brings us right back to that memorable insight you teased at the start, that actual think tank in the 60s trying to turn West Germany into a cybernetic model.
Yeah, the fact that they tried to treat lawyers like algorithms.
And failed miserably.
So, our mission for this deep dive is to unpack where your modern obsession with forecasting and data modeling actually comes from. We want to look at how early futurists literally trying to hack the government, and more importantly, what their massive failures teach you about the absolute limits of data.
So, to really understand why governments suddenly thought they could control the future, we kind of have to rewind a bit. We need to look at the massive technological shifts of the 1940s and 50s.
Because before this era, the future was basically seen as a fate to be accepted, right? Like you had historical prophecies, but you didn't really have prognostics.
Right. Before World War II, the future was largely inevitable. You couldn't change it, you just kind of braced for it. But post-war, thinkers at places like the RAND Corporation began to view the future differently. They started seeing it as a multitude of possibilities that could actually be manipulated.
And the paper introduces this great term for that, coined by the French political scientist Bertrand de Jouvenel Futuribles.
Yes, futurible. So future plus possible.
It's a great concept. It basically means the future isn't just one track, it's a sandbox of possibilities.
Exactly. And that sandbox mentality had three very distinct routes that gave these researchers so much confidence. The first route was operations research from World War II.
Which was basically military math.
Yeah, exactly. Using strict mathematics to optimize military logistics, they figured out exactly how to route supply convoys to minimize the mathematical probability of submarine attacks. And it worked incredibly well.
Okay, so that's route one. What was the second?
The second was big science. This is best represented by the Manhattan Project. Governments suddenly learned that if they organized thousands of scientists and just threw infinite money at them, they could achieve these massive, seemingly impossible technological leaps.
Right. I mean, if you can invent an atomic bomb on a strict deadline, you probably start to feel pretty invincible.
You really do. But the third route, And honestly, the most important one for this whole movement was cybernetics.
Ah, cybernetics. It sounds so retro-futuristic now.
It does. But at the time, it was this massive meta-science of communication and control in systems. The underlying theory was that biological systems, physical machines, and human societies all fundamentally do the same thing. They process information, and they use feedback loops.
So the logic was, if you can map the feedback loop of a society, you can control the society.
Precisely. Seafried highlights this amazing quote from Olaf Helmer in 1967. He was a prominent researcher at RAND, and he wrote that societal planning was shifting from haphazard intuitive gambles to sober and craftsmanlike analysis.
So let me get this straight. Basically, because we figured out how to build a nuclear bomb and we knew how to calculate the physics of missile trajectories, these thinkers just assumed society was another machine.
Yeah, that was the leap they made.
Like, if you can calculate the physical trajectory of a rocket, you can just calculate the socioeconomic trajectory of the middle class.
Exactly. That assumption is the absolute foundation of the era. But once that idea took hold, the idea that the future could be steered, you suddenly had all these different academic disciplines rushing in, trying to grab the steering wheel for themselves.
Right. And this is where Seyfried's three categories from the paper become so important, because people had completely different flavors of how to do this.
Right. So let's break down the first one. She calls this the empirical or positivist approach.
These are the spreadsheet guys, basically.
Definitely. This camp was led by natural scientists, mathematicians, and engineers. They relied heavily on early computer simulations, trend extrapolations, and strict systems analysis.
And the key figure here is Hermann Kahn, right? From the RAND Corporation.
Yes. Hermann Kahn is fascinating because he is best known for his incredibly cynical wargaming of nuclear scenarios.
I want to make sure we pause on that, because the mechanism of how he did this is wild. He wasn't just theorizing about the Cold War. He was assigning mathematical probabilities to human survival in a nuclear holocaust.
Right. Instead of treating a nuclear exchange as just an unthinkable world-ending apocalypse, Kahn approached it as a quantifiable system. He would calculate the blast radius, map the fallout patterns, measure the economic devastation, and even quantify the psychological impact.
And then he'd just present strategic options based on the math.
Exactly. The positivist belief was that if you aggressively model the absolute worst-case scenario with hard data, you can predict and control aspects of the aftermath. It was a very cold, raw, data-driven kind of forecasting.
Okay, but if Kahn is literally running the numbers on Armageddon, there had to be people looking at that and just being totally horrified by the cold detachment of it.
Oh, absolutely. Which leads us directly to Seyfried's second category, the normative or ontological approach.
So who are the normatives?
This camp was led by philosophers and physicists who saw forecasting as an art, not just a science. When we say ontological, we mean they were deeply concerned with the fundamental nature of human existence and values.
They were skeptical of just blindly trusting technology.
Right. They believed in science, but they thought the positivists were missing the human element. This is where Bertrand de Jouvenel comes back in. He famously argued that foreseeing depends on looking, meaning you shouldn't just look at data points on a screen. You have to look at actual human values.
And the paper also talks about Carl Friedrich von Weizsäcker here, right? He was a German physicist.
Yes, and Weizsäcker is a great contrast to Hermann Kahn. He also ran a massive study on the consequences of nuclear war, but his methodology was entirely different.
How so?
Well, instead of wargaming survival tactics and blast radii, Weizsäcker ran a qualitative assessment of what a nuclear war would actually do to the social and moral fabric of West Germany.
Oh, so he wasn't just asking how many survive. He was asking what kind of world are they surviving in?
Exactly. His goal was normative. He was looking for what the future should be. And he used his findings to actively push for detente, basically trying to ease geopolitical tensions. He argued that permanent nuclear deterrence was just inherently unstable.
So you've got the empirical guys building the math models and the normative guys debating the ethics and values. Where do the activists fit into all this?
That's the third camp, the critical or emancipatory approach. These thinkers were grounded in social philosophy and idealism. Their whole goal was to emancipate human beings from the very systems that the positivists were so obsessed with building.
They wanted to break the machine, not steer it.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Key figures here were people like the historian Robert Junk and the peace researcher Johann Galtung. They completely rejected top-down technocratic control.
And the paper mentions they created something called Mankind 2000, right? And they ran these future workshops.
Yeah, the mechanism for their research was entirely grassroots. Instead of feeding data into a government mainframe, they gathered everyday citizens in a room. They wanted ordinary people to brainstorm and invent their own willed futures from the bottom up.
Okay, I have to push back on this categorization a little bit, or at least point something out.
Sure, what is it?
You have these grassroots peace activists running community workshops on one side, and on the other side, you have RAND scientists running top-down nuclear war games on supercomputers. They sound like polar
Looks like
opposites, right?
on the surface, absolutely.
But aren't they fundamentally trying to do the exact same thing? I mean, they both look at the messy present and think, we have the tools to engineer a better version of humanity. They both think they can invent a new man. They just violently disagree on what that man is supposed to look like.
That is a really great observation, and it's actually the exact common thread that Seefried highlights in her synthesis. She calls it the intrinsic code of futures research.
The intrinsic code. I like that.
Yeah. Despite all their massive political and ideological differences, all three of these approaches shared the exact same fundamental conviction that multiple futures exist and that the future is creatable by us.
So whether you use a supercomputer or a town hall meeting, the underlying assumption is that society is basically clay waiting to be molded.
Exactly. But here's where the story gets really interesting. While the philosophers were debating ethics and the activists were holding their workshops, the empirical positivists, the spreadsheet guys, actually got the keys to the government.
This is the part I've been waiting for. We need to shift focus to West Germany in the late 1960s, because this is where all this high-minded theory crashes headfirst into messy reality.
Right. To set the stage, 1960s West Germany was going through a massive wave of reform. Politicians across the entire spectrum, from Willy Brandt's Social Democrats all the way to the conservative Christian Democrats, were suddenly embracing Keynesian economics.
Which is the idea that the government should actively intervene to smooth out the bumps of the economy.
Yes, they wanted rational, scientifically backed politics. They were tired of making policy based on gut feelings and political horse trading. They wanted hard data.
And waiting for them with open arms was the Center Berlin for Futures Research.
Led by Heinz Hermann Kohl.
Right. And we have to talk about Kohl's background because it is just too perfect for this story. He was literally an aerospace engineer who used to work at NASA.
It explains everything about his worldview. He takes the exact same mindset that put a man on the moon, brings it back to Berlin, and decides he's going to apply systems engineering to government bureaucracy.
What could possibly go wrong?
Well, the center gets a massive 2 million mark contract from the government for a project called PLEBUND, that stands for Planning Aid in the Federal Administration.
2 million marks was a huge amount of money back then, and their stated goal was to, quote, rationalize the federal administration.
Right. And to do this, they created a system called BSI, the Berlin Simulation Model. BSI was designed to take an incredibly complex social system and break it down into perfectly quantifiable components.
I really want you, the listener, to picture how wild the mechanism for this actually was. They would literally take a speech given by a mayor and they would try to extract mathematical variables from it.
Yeah, they would map the frequency of certain words or categorize policy promises and then feed that into a simulated social matrix.
And the goal was to trigger an early warning system. So, like, if the math suggested the mayor's speech was going to cause economic friction in 6 months, a little warning light would theoretically flash on a dashboard for the policymakers.
It's pure techno-utopianism.
Huh.
They honestly believed that social complexity was just a computing problem. If you categorized enough data, you could assign an accurate number to human sentiment.
And if that wasn't ambitious or arrogant enough, they launched a second project alongside it called EIPE, the Experimental Integrating Planning and Decision-Making System.
Yeah, EIPE is where the project crossed the line from ambitious to pure hubris.
Definitely. What did EIPE actually do?
They deployed a team of sociologists, economists, and political scientists directly into the federal ministries for 3 months. Their job was to conduct participatory observation.
Which is a polite way of saying they were shadowing government bureaucrats. But they weren't just watching them file papers, or they were actively trying to quantify what they called their non-rational determinants.
Exactly. Let's break down what that meant in practice. Say a government administrator makes a decision based on a legal precedent, or a politician compromises on a bill because it helps them get reelected.
Normal political stuff.
Right, normal human stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But the researchers viewed all of that as inefficient bias. They wanted to capture that human intuition, measure exactly how much political leeway the bureaucrat had, and lock it all into what they called a categorical filing arsenal.
A categorical filing arsenal. Just the phrasing is so aggressive.
It really is. They wanted to mathematically map the political wiggle room of real human beings.
This is where I have to laugh at the sheer engineering hubris of this. I mean, think about it. If I'm a lawyer working in a ministry and some NASA aerospace engineer comes in and tells me my 20 years of legal expertise is just a statistical variable that needs to be minimized for system efficiency.
Then you're not going to like it.
I'm not just going to dislike it. I'm going to actively sabotage the project. It's like trying to forcefully install a software efficiency update on a group of lawyers. It's never going to work.
And your reaction is exactly what happened in reality. The bureaucrats mounted a full-scale immune response against the researchers. Seyfried's paper details this massive language and culture clash between the two groups.
I can only imagine the meetings.
Oh, they were terrible. The researchers spoke in this dense, inflated cybernetic jargon. But the administrators, most of whom had deep traditional backgrounds in law, communicated in terms of precedent and legal frameworks. They literally couldn't speak the same language.
But the administrators weren't stupid. They must have realized pretty quickly what EIPE was actually trying to achieve.
Oh, they saw the threat immediately. This wasn't just an academic exercise. This was fundamentally a battle over power. By trying to quantify and systematize the decision-making process, the researchers were actively attempting to restrict a bureaucrat's political leeway.
Right, because if a cybernetic computer model dictates that, mathematically, your department's budget must be cut by 12% to optimize the state, you lose your power to negotiate. You lose your ability to compromise and survive politically.
Exactly. The computer says no, so you have no power. Once the administration realized that, they simply insulated themselves. They closed ranks, stopped cooperating, and shut the researchers out completely.
So the grand 2 million mark cybernetic dream hits a solid brick wall of human self-preservation.
Yep. The funding for the BESI simulation was discontinued step by step. The EIPE project faced heavy criticism for lacking any practical use whatsoever. And within the cabinet itself, the other ministries felt deeply threatened by the chancellery's massive planning ambitions.
They became a laughingstock, didn't they?
They did. The planners became a running joke in the government. The cabinet famously mocked the entire futures department as a child steam engine.
Ouch. Calling a group of Apollo-era aerospace scientists a child steam engine is just a brutal historical takedown.
It was the end of the line for them. By the early 1970s, the money dried up entirely. But, you know, there are also massive external forces at work that basically prove the positivists wrong on a global scale.
Right. The real world intervened. What happened?
Well, in 1973, the oil crisis hit. This was a massive, totally unpredictable economic shock, a true black swan event. And none of these highly tuned linear simulation models had predicted it.
Well, yeah, because a computer simulation analyzing a mayor's speech in Berlin can't exactly predict a global oil embargo in the Middle East.
Exactly. The variables were too vast. Furthermore, in 1972, the incredibly famous book, The Limits to Growth, was published by the Club of Rome. Now, that book also used computer modeling, but not to show how we could infinitely steer the economy. It showed that unchecked economic growth would lead to ecological collapse.
So the entire cultural paradigm shifted. We went from blind techno-optimism to a much more sobering kind of defensive ecological awareness.
Yes. The euphoria of steering basically evaporated overnight.
So what did the Center Berlin for Futures Research do after all this? After their cybernetic models were literally mocked out of the government and the oil crisis proved them wrong, did they just pack up and quit?
Well, to their credit, they adapted. By 1975, they released a new policy paper that marked a massive pivot for the organization. They explicitly moved away from what they called impressive demonstrations of technical capacity.
Meaning the big, flashy computer models.
Right. They pivoted toward a much more pragmatic, socially oriented approach. And most importantly, they formally admitted in writing that political decision-making cannot be completely modeled or quantified.
Wow. So they finally conceded defeat to human nature.
They did. Yeah. The era of thinking we could calculate society like a rocket trajectory was officially over. We built these incredibly elaborate systems, handed the keys to the government, and just crashed headfirst into the reality that human behavior, political survival, and bureaucratic instinct will always resist being put into a categorical filing arsenal.
That epistemological clash, that battle over how we actually define and measure reality, I think that's the core takeaway here. The euphoria of steering shattered against the rocks of human complexity.
It's a great historical reminder. Data and models are incredibly useful tools, obviously, But a society is not a machine that can be perfectly tuned from a dashboard.
And I want you, the listener, to really think about how this history echoes in your own daily life right now, because it absolutely does.
Oh, yeah.
Whenever you see a new, highly complex data model rolled out at your workplace, like a new KPI dashboard or an algorithmic management tool or some new efficiency software that claims it can perfectly quantify your productivity, you are witnessing the exact same mindset from the 1960s.
You're dealing with the intellectual descendants of the Center Berlin for Futures Research. They're still trying to put your non-rational determinants into a filing arsenal.
Exactly. The belief that the unmeasurable, messy aspects of human labor and interaction can and should be measured is still very much alive today.
It never really went away. The tools just got faster.
Which leaves you with a final lingering thought to mull over. Today, we have largely replaced retro terms like cybernetics and systems analysis with artificial intelligence and predictive algorithms. We look at our massive neural networks and we think, hey, our current tech is finally good enough to do what those 1960s futurists failed to do. They just didn't have enough processing power.
That's the common assumption, yeah.
But if the fundamental problem back then wasn't the lack of computing power, if the actual root problem was that human society, by its very nature, actively resists being quantified and steered, are we just repeating the exact same euphoria of steering today, completely blind to the crash that is inevitably coming?
That is a very unsettling question.
Something to keep in mind the next time someone promises you an algorithm can predict the future. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the limits of forecasting, and we'll see you next time on Futures Research Unpacked.